I'm Stephen Metcalf, and this is the Slate Culture Gabfest, Timothy Chalamet Rides the Worm edition. It's Wednesday, March 6th, 2024. On today's show, Dune 2 is the much-delayed, much-anticipated sequel to Dune, Denis Villeneuve's adaptation of the sci-fi classic, starring Timothy Chalamet. And then, the filmmaker Richard Linklater has given us so many movies, Dazed and Confused, School of Rock, Boyhood. He's now produced a three-part documentary about his home state of Texas. God Save Texas is on streaming. It's on Max. We avidly discuss with Dana, our in-house Texan.
I wish I'd worn my Texas-shaped belt buckle.
You pack in heat, Dana, in case something goes down here. All right. Anyway, and finally, there will be in 2025 an Oscar statue for casting. Here to discuss what a strange and subtle art casting a movie is Paul Schnee. He's the casting director for, oh my gosh, the movies. I mean, it really is an incredible list when you think of Pitch Perfect, Spotlight, Winter's Bone, Dallas Buyers Club. I think what they have in common is they are beautifully cast movies. Anyway, we're psyched to talk to him. But first, joining me today is Julia Turner of the Annenberg Journalism School. She's a fellow there. Julia, how's it going?
Hello, hello.
And of course, Dana Stevens is the film critic for Slate. Hello, Dana.
Howdy.
All right, let's dive in. Dune is, of course, the sci-fi classic, the much-beloved doorstop from Frank Herbert. It took a circuitous and tormented journey to a successful screen adaptation, which Dune, in 2021, was. And then, of course, COVID prevented a release of the sequel. Well, here it is, Dune 2. Timothy Chalamet is Paul Atreides, heir to the House of Atreides, who may or may not also be a prophesied messiah. There is so much built-out world-building here. I think for now, maybe we'll leave it there and say only this epic, sand-choked film stars Timothy Chalamet, Zendaya, and the cast includes Florence Pugh, Christopher Walken, Austin Butler, Rebecca Ferguson. I mean, it's a huge and wonderful cast. All right, in the scene we're about to hear, Chalamet as Paul is preparing for the chief rite of passage among the Fremen natives of Dune. It involves wrangling a worm the size of a cruise ship. Coaching him is Stilgar, played by Javier Bardem. We're going to hear jeers and banter in the film's constructed Fremen language. Let's have a listen.
I tune it myself. Here.
Thanks.
Don't try to impress anyone. You're brave. We all know that. Be simple. Be direct. Nothing fancy.
Nothing fancy.
Hey! I'm serious. Nothing fancy. You will shame my teaching.
I won't shame you. I understand.
Shai Hulu decides today if you become Fremen. Or if you die.
Emwadib! Soko Muzma! Jarva Vahcha!
For the record, I watched and loved this movie. I just can't.
Oh, no,
it.
It's a lot. It takes forever to summarize the plot. That's why my review is like 1,300 words long.
There's a way of being, let me put it this way, a way of being lost in a universe that makes you feel as though the universe is real and not half-baked. And it seems to me that hurdle is cleared here by quite a margin. What'd you make of it?
Yeah, I totally agree. The fact that you had trouble summarizing all of the sort of strands that come together in your summary goes to my exact experience writing my review. I had to do so much reading just to sort of state what happened. And yet I think what Denis Villeneuve really carries off is that, yeah, while you're watching this movie, that doesn't bother you. It doesn't feel like plot holes or this is too many names to remember. You know, it's a vast, vast, complex world. Obviously, in the books, much more complex and things had to be condensed and I'm sure many, many things left out. But over the course of these two films, which I think are really, it's really more correct to think of as two halves of a movie. If you saw the first Dune, you know that it ended like way in the middle of the action, like to a degree that I and some other critics really did not like the ending of that movie.
Groans in the theater that I saw it in.
Right. I mean, it was teasing things that never, ever happened, including a lot of this, you know, great sandworm action scenes that we finally get in the second movie. So I think a lot of other critics preferred Dune 2 to the first Dune, although I think the two interlock really nicely together. And I can imagine, you know, a back-to-back screening being really satisfying. I would say the main element that I have to praise about these movies, and especially the second one, is that unlike a lot of big action blockbusters that sort of attempt to fold in some allegorical meaning in order to bolster their own importance. This movie, like the Herbert books, is legitimately about, you know, big political and social questions, right? I mean, it's about, among other things, authoritarian politics, right? And kind of the draw of fascist aesthetics and, you know, the appeal of a religious leader. This is far from being one of those chosen one movies that, you know, sort of elevates the young white messiah. In fact, it is, I would say, it's leaning toward being in the next movie that is no doubt about to be announced, a deconstruction and a rejection of that whole model. I just thought it was much smarter about politics and about the contemporary themes that it folds in than lots and lots of, you know, blockbusters I could name that sort of, you know, borrow on that to lend themselves a little moral weight that they didn't really earn.
Yeah, here, here. Julia, what about you?
I loved this movie, and it made me feel like the retroactive impoverishment of a bunch of movies that we have seen and discussed in the last 10 years.
Yes.
Like, you're like, oh, right, a movie can be this. This is what a movie should be. Like, all the stupid grayscale, you know, the spaceships, the color of the foil that you scratch off of a dollar bodega lottery ticket. Like, it just is beautiful. It sort of takes up thematically the Lawrence of Arabia story, which is one of the most beautiful movies ever made. And it uses similar terrain to tell a very different story. And the production design is incredible. From the very opening scene where we see some baddies in these floating jetpack suits that kind of give them the motion of like scuba divers or astronauts at the space station. Like, they have kind of a weird gravitylessness, but there's a lot. They're not just like zooming around. Like, there is a real weighted physical logic to every element of the film. The production design is incredible. The fight choreography is incredible. I was totally transported. I mean, it is long. It is long. I won't claim that I never looked at my watch. And it's incredibly arresting as we see our buddy Timmy settle into life among the Fremen. And then we kind of zoom out and go to some other galaxies and worlds within the Dune universe that took me a minute to kind of grab my attention. But damn, I loved it. And I think I was on maternity leave when you guys talked about the first one. So I was coming to it completely cold. And it really, despite starting in midstream, it really worked for me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, me too. I mean, this movie did very big business, as I understand it, which is a good sign. I remember seeing the first one, Dana, and correct me if I'm wrong. I think we liked it, but I had to keep checking to make sure I liked it as much as I did, because I didn't quite follow it, quite understand what I was watching, had not read the Herbert books. And I remember it not being greeted quite as positively as this one, perhaps, both critically and commercially. And now just complete vindication for what appears to be a franchise. I mean, we started doing the show roughly around when Iron Man came out. We have coincided with peak TV and with the comic book blockbuster tentpole, right, that has sort of propped up the movie business since. And it was a real drag going back over and over again to these sprawling 3-hour portentous CGI crammed chaotic nonsensical portentous messes and pretending they were real movies. What's so funny, Julia, is exactly right. I love the retrospective dismay that you feel for so many movies that we sort of strained to treat respectfully and were trying to do this and didn't do this. And what's amazing is how close it is to being all of the bad things, or you know, it's like, in a way, it is sort of portentous and slow. And yet everything seems so earned. The allegory is wonderful. I mean, this is a movie about colonial extractive practices and the macro politics and micro politics of competing for a raw material, spice in this universe, and what happens to the place where those things happen to be deposited in abundance. It's also, as you say, Dana, beautifully, it's exactly that. It's a parable against charisma, the very charisma that typically carries these movies, the messianic charisma of the hero who's typically white, typically male, and may or may not be some kind of a prophet or messiah. And the great thing about this one is he sort of seems to be who's been prophesied, and yet the movie becomes, and I did not know this about the Herbert books. So for me, I was confused. I was like, what am I watching? It's completely undermining his supposed chosenness and oneness and greatness vis-a-vis his relationship to Zendaya, which is totally gripping. And it, to me, was unexpected.
Can we talk a little bit about Timmy? Because I will confess that his like fundamental wonkiness was kind of knocking me in the head a little bit for the first few scenes. Like, there's a way in which he shows up, and in every scene for the first hour of the movie, he kind of seems like he's like the pizza delivery guy. Like, everyone else is like in the world and they're like wrapped up in their amazing outfits and beads. And he's like, hey guys, we having an insurrection here? Like, he just has this like, even though he's a New York kid, he has this kind of like California dude vibe to him that sort of cut against and sort of worked for the kind of fish out of water narrative. And I spent the first hour of the movie being like, is Timmy Chalamet our best actor or our worst actor? Like, he's definitely incredibly charismatic. Like, he definitely works as a movie star. I am not and would not question that. Don't worry. Don't come find me. But like, the manner of his acting is so odd. And then it kind of carries you along. Anyway, Dana, I'm very curious to hear you talk about that performance.
For one thing, and I've heard other people sort of laughingly talk about Wonka in relation to Timothy Chalamet. Didn't we just all agree that he was really miscast as Wonka? Why are we saying that that is the essence of Timothy Chalamet? We're about to talk to a casting director later in this show, and maybe he would be somebody who would have an opinion on Timothy Chalamet and which roles he's right for. But what I say in my review, and I really believe this, is, I mean, I don't need to see Timothy Chalamet's Hamlet. You know, he doesn't need to transform or, you know, his Elephant Man or whatever, some incredibly transfiguring role that he would take on. Maybe later on in his career, you know, he'll be ready for those things. Right now, he is, you know, the Kwisatz Haderach, you know, the messiah of movie starness. And I think he, when he's properly cast, as I think he is in the Dune movies, as he was in Little Women, where I loved him, as he was in Call Me By Your Name, the first place most of us saw him, right, where he's like divinely perfect for that role. Yes. When he's right, there's nobody else you could imagine in the role. And that is exactly how I feel about his Paul Atreides. I mean, because this role is what I think it was the critic David Ehrlich called a Twiggy princeling, which is so perfect, right? And Timothy has that quality of being his character. Paul Atreides is supposed to be sheltered, right? Brought up in unimaginable luxury, but also, you know, he has all of this weight put upon him to sort of represent the family. He is a princely kind of figure who is a fish out of water when he finds himself in the real world, you know, fighting battles on a dusty planet.
I'd also add that if I follow the movie correctly, he's surrounded by people who believe he is the Messiah, but he doesn't believe it. It's instrumental to him to get his desired revenge. So in a way, he needs to be a little bit out of the role, if you know what I mean.
Can we talk a little bit about, for lack of a less academic word, like the Orientalist imagery of this film? Like, obviously, the point of the film, it seems, and I, from what I gather, some of the point of the book is to kind of challenge and make us think twice about some of the classic narratives of the Twiggy princeling who comes to save everybody else. But the visual rhetoric of the film at some moments, and sometimes at moments where it's trying to make us feel how odd and off and inappropriate it is for this white visitor to rise as the ruler of the Fremen, didn't feel, they felt a little bit like they were trading on some classic Hollywood cliches. And it's been commented too that there's not very many Arab actors in this movie that is kind of trading on some of these themes. What did you guys think about that critique and about those elements of the film?
I mean, I feel like to answer that more fully, I wish I knew the Herbert novels better and that one of us was a reader of at least some of those books, because I know that Herbert was taking on what you mentioned earlier, Julia, the T.E. Lawrence myth very deliberately and was trying to take on colonialism, right, and to critique colonialism. So whether or not in the process of doing that, he engaged in some of his own kind of exotic, you know, almost reverse racism, right, a kind of idealization of an exotic native culture, I really can't speak to that. I mean, I don't think that the movie traffics in that in a cynical way. but I'm a white critic watching it, you know, and I would be very curious to hear, especially what a Middle Eastern reader of the novels thinks about, you know, about the entire franchise and the way that it's handled.
I came away feeling like I need to reserve judgment for the Dune 3, for, which seems like it must be coming, to see what happens, like what happens with this arc. But, you know, not all of the portrayals were reverse racist positive portrayals. There were, although there were some, you know, wise men of the desert, but there were also some like fundamentalist throngs, you know, like the movie has enough sophistication and enough intelligence that I want to give it a chance to go where it's going to go in the next film. But a lot of those tensions and the question of what it's doing with those images and those themes are unresolved based on where this lands. And so it's a bit of a leap of faith for me.
All right. It's Dune 2. We seem to be, you know, pretty united in our admiration for it. Check it out. It's in theaters and it's shaping up to be a big hit. All right. Before we go any further, this is where we typically discuss business. Dana, what do we have?
We have a couple items of business this week. One is, as always, to tell listeners about today's Slate Plus segment. This week, we're answering a question from a listener named Elliot, who wrote in to ask about pieces of media or culture that our children have introduced us to for the first time. So we've talked before about, you know, revisiting things that we loved in our own childhood with kids and kid culture in general, kid literature. This is just about any sort of culture that you know about only because your offspring told you about it. And I know I have lots of things to talk about there. I think we all will. The other piece of business I wanted to mention is that if you are a Slate Plus member, we're doing a little Oscars event this Thursday, March the 7th. It starts at 5 p.m. Eastern time and I think runs about an hour. It's just going to be an Oscars-themed live chat discussion. I think there's some Oscars trivia in there with Dan Coyce running the show. It's going to be me, Dan Coyce, Sam Adams of Slate, and our beloved Indira Goff. So all folks that have appeared often on this show to talk about culture. And we're not prognosticating about what will win. We're just sort of batting around fun discussions about the ceremony. And if you Zoom in, you can discuss with us. If you're a Slate Plus member, you can sign up for that Zoom event on the site. And of course, if you're not a Slate Plus member, you can always become one at slate.com/culture plus. When you're a member, you get ad-free podcasts and bonus content like our extra segments or that Zoom event I described. And of course, you get unlimited access to all of the writing and podcasting on slate.com. These memberships are really part of what keeps the magazine afloat. So please, if you haven't already, sign up today at slate.com/culture plus. And Julia, I think you had something to add this week.
Oh, yeah. We're just in the middle of a mini promo drive, let's call it. We would remind you here that we do not, in fact, bother you every week and tell you to like and subscribe and leave a comment on wherever you listen to podcasts, as many podcasts do, because it kind of becomes white noise, right? However, it is very valuable in this crowded podcast landscape when you like and subscribe and leave a comment and tell a friend, hey, I think you might like this show. So if you enjoy our discussions, please do those things. Click us up wherever you listen. Give us the old heart, the like, the thumbs up, the stars. Leave a note. And if you are a word of mouth evangelist for podcasts to the podcast listeners in your life, tell them to check us out and give us a try. It really helps people discover what we do, and we love connecting with all of you.
The new Starz series, Mary and George, starring Julianne Moore and Nicholas Galitzine, tells a story almost too outrageous to be true, but shockingly, it is. With next to nothing to her name and looking to elevate her social standing, Mary Villiers sets her handsome and charming son, George, on the path to seduce King James I and become his all-powerful lover. Trust me, you've never seen a mother-son duo like this before. This show is full of wit, scandal, action, and did I mention Julianne Moore? Something this audacious and sexy is as genre-bending as it gets. You won't be able to look away. Watch the season premiere of Mary and George now, only on Starz and the Starz app. Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on all your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval, terms apply.
All right, the filmmaker Richard Linklater has made many, many movies, but beginning with his breakthrough one, Slack, or A Remarkable Number, have something in common. They take place in Texas, his home state. Now he returns to try to understand a place that contains multitudes, to put it mildly. I mean, it's a gigantic landmass that thinks of itself as an independent republic. It's diverse in population, but still substantially owned and politically dominated by white men. Linkletter's three-part God Save Texas begins by examining the apparently Texan love of the death penalty. He complicates that enormously along the way. The focus in that first episode is on Linkletter's own hometown of Huntsville. The show then moves on to the oil and gas industry and finally the state's relationship to Mexico and immigration. Those installments are courtesy of the filmmakers Alex Stapleton and Ileana Sosa, respectively. Each is returning to their respective hometown. Also, the project is based on the Lawrence Wright book of the same name, and he appears in on screen quite a bit. Our clip is coming from episode one, which, as I said, explores how a local prison pulls the entire community of Huntsville into its gravity. Here, a former official for the prison recalls presiding over executions there.
I remember my first execution. I remember the feeling that I had when I saw this guy 1 minute and he was fine, and the next minute he was deceased. So it had a profound impact on me. I actually went to a minister and talked to him about okay, how do I want to make sure my soul wasn't going to hell. He basically told me that mankind is supposed to obey the laws of the land, and if the laws of the land is execution and that is your job, then so be it.
All right, Dana, we're going to break form here a little bit and start with you. You're from Texas. Really curious to know what you make of this. Maybe talk a little bit about where you're from in Texas and how much this documentary touches on the Texas that you know, and what you make of it as a, piece of work.
I mean, I think a huge thing that these three episodes get across is how vast Texas is and how many different experiences and cultures and terrains exist within it, right? I mean, at some point, somebody says, I think it's in one of the later episodes, that the geographical size of Texas is roughly the same as France, the entire country of France, right? I mean, just driving across it takes, an entire day. So even though this is set in three different places, none of them resemble the Texas that I grew up in. The closest would probably be the episode that's about El Paso and Ciudad Juarez and about that border space, because I'm from San Antonio, which is a bit closer to the border, but not right on it. But all of these spaces were essentially completely new to me and incredible to explore. This made me wish, this three-part, Texas documentary made me wish that every red state, or every state that is thought of in the popular imagination as, this undifferentiated space of Republican voters, would get something like this on television so we could explore the communities that exist within it. Because it's a cliche at this point to say about Texas, but it's so true, is that Texas is not, in fact, a red state. It's a blue state that is being, voter suppressed and various forms of chicanery are turning it into a red state. But every city in Texas votes blue, right? The populations that we're looking at, especially in these later two episodes that are about Black population of Houston and the Mexican-American kind of mixture that's happening in Juarez and El Paso, are places that are about the future of America and not the past. That's why there is such a strong, push against them within the Texas government. So to get portraits of people that are actually living in those conditions that Greg Abbott and Ken Paxton are creating for them, unfortunately, to me is exactly what we need in an election year. This is not an overtly political documentary. I mean, it's about, local politics. It's not really talking about this red state, blue state stuff that I'm talking about. But I found myself wishing, why aren't we learning about different Ohio communities, different Florida communities, getting some sense of what these states are besides the monolithic way that they look to us in polls. I will also say, because Linklater is involved, and this is especially true of his episode, the first one, there's a lot of humor and sort of local color and fun conversations in diners, that this is, although the stories that are being told are in many cases tragic, certainly the episode about Huntsville, the execution capital of the state, is full of incredibly sad stories. But there's also a real sense of the local community, and you really get a sense of what it's like to be in that place, to walk down the street, to go to the schools, to eat in the restaurants. And I love that local aspect of it.
Julia, what'd you make of this? It's kind of a remarkable project. And we should say it's really three, in some ways, very distinct directorial presences and voices. All three directors are on camera substantially. They're all returning to a place they're from.
And chatting with Lawrence Wright on camera.
And chatting with Lawrence Wright on camera and talking to people that they know, including incredibly close family members and old friends. What do you make of this mix, Julia?
I found this documentary slash series of documentaries to be shaggy. And part of its charm is its shag. And it's almost got the quality of a ride-along, right? Like, you've got these three talented, interesting directors. They're revisiting their hometowns and they're kind of taking you on a personal and political journey that tries to square the Texas they grew up in with the Texas they've come to understand more about as they get older. And so there's a wisdom to it and a personalness to it and an exploratory quality to it that I feel slightly Grinch-like for having been somewhat impatient with. But it was like a little too shaggy for me. I watched almost the entire thing. I didn't quite finish the last one. And I'm glad. But Dana, if that project happened, I would not watch all those movies. It was too long. It was not tight enough. It was a little too, like, too ride-along-y. I don't know that the pull to ride along was sharp or tight enough for me. Am I being just a Scrooge?
Yeah, Julia, I think I stand behind the shaggy, and maybe it is because I have my own local interest. But like I say, it's not that it's my story that makes me like it. It's that I feel like these people are telling their own stories in a way that draws me in. And I will say, and I hate to say this to be unfair to the other two filmmakers who obviously are less famous veteran filmmakers than Rick Linklater is, but I think his segment is probably the best one. And in part, it's because he's able to weave in some bits from his work, right? Where you see how autobiographical, for example, Dazed and Confused or the movie Everybody Wants Some, you know, which takes place in this sort of like frat house of college baseball players, that, you know, that those things are tied to specific locations. It's almost like this is the secret story of his hometown that he wasn't able to tell, you know, and that he's apparently been, you know, kind of recording footage about, you know, death penalty issues in Huntsville for decades. And so it felt to me like a personal diary entry from Richard Linklater, and who wouldn't be interested in hearing that?
It's his installment. The first one was like about an hour and 20. It's a substantial film, in a way, a documentary. I think it's beautifully done. I agree. It integrates autobiography, the ride along, the interviews with Wright, but then a dozen or more people that he seems to have some kind of personal history with. And at the center of it is this weird, gigantic, almost like medieval fort that dominates the middle of the town. It's a prison and where executions happen at an alarming rate. I mean, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people killed. And you talk to people who are involved in the machinery of killing and what their relationship to it was. These are people who, by process of selection, self-selection, couldn't keep doing it. And then I think the series became somewhat what Julia said, though I think the third is very, very, very strong. All of it is informative. What I would say, Dana, a slight quibble with something you said, if I might, which is that I think it's exceedingly openly and passionately political project from beginning to end. It's not partisan. I think you're right about that.
I guess I was just not talking about national politics is what I should have said. You know, it's not talking about the presidential election or where Texas falls in the red state, blue state.
It's not partisan, right? And it doesn't. And what I like about it most, Julia, is that it humanizes, subtilizes, looks close up at a world in which horrific things happen without producing the false empathy by which political anger dissipates and disappears. It's totally unsentimental while being deeply human and to me, and angering and motivating. And to be all of those things at once probably requires a degree of shagginess, but is also, to my mind, you know, just admirable.
Those interviews with people who work, basically the woman who was doing like PR for Death Row, was extraordinary. Like some of those conversations were really fascinating. And throughout, there were a bunch of these moments in the second one too. The thing that the shagginess allowed for, which I did like about the project, was just these kind of plain, not too pointed, not propagandistic, open-minded, curious questions about how people live with near affected by perpetrating, in some cases, injustice, right? You know, they just experience it as life. It's just part of the shape of life. And those moments are profound and beautiful. And I, even in my desire, my editor's desire for everything to be tighter, 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 more focus, more focus, more focus, I can see that the space given here allows for something unusual. I'm definitely glad that I watched these. I just think if I had not been assigned to watch these for this conversation, I would not have watched them all. And I do not relish the other 49 states projects along these lines. Although maybe I should, given what I just said. But just in terms of my own taste and attention, you have to be ready for a shaggy hang.
Okay. Well, it's God Save Texas, courtesy of Richard Linklater and two other directors. It's on Max. Mixed feelings here. If you happen to watch it, let us know what you thought. All right, let's move on.
This podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you're driving, cooking, or doing laundry, Progressive knows the podcasts you listen to go best when they're bundled with another activity, much like how their Progressive home and auto policies go best when they're bundled. Having these two policies together makes taking care of your insurance easier and could help you save, too. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. That's a whole lot of savings and protection for your favorite podcast listening activities, like going on a road trip, cooking dinner, and even hitting the gym. Yep, your home and your car are even easier to protect when you bundle your insurance together. Find your perfect combo. Get a home and car insurance quote at progressive.com today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.
Here's the thing about films. The medium is defined by the just there-ness of it, right? The people saying the words you believe are real people speaking spontaneously. So in a successful film, or a measure of a successful film, is sort of how hidden all of the craft work that went into making it is in some sense. And what's more important to a film or more hidden than casting? Joining us now is Paul Schnee. The list of films that he has cast is amazing. Amazing in itself as films, but they're such beautifully cast movies, Paul. Spotlight, Winter's Bone, Dallas Buyers Club, Pitch Perfect. That's incredible. There is now a statue, finally, belatedly, for what you do. And just to clarify, they're going to award it for 2025 movies for the first time. Therefore, we'll get an award ceremony with the statue handed over only in 2026. You would have won at least one had there been one previously.
Maybe, yeah.
And we're really psyched and really honored to have you to discuss what it is you do, because for all the smoke I just blew, I'm still not 100% sure, but that just says that it's an art,
still
not
exactly
a science.
Still not sure what we do.
But I really want to hear you speak to what is the art that goes into, and what in the process. You must begin with a long dialogue, a long engagement with a script, and it only ends with a single name and a single face attached to a part.
Right. Well, first off, thanks so much for having me on. It's really a pleasure. It's a very strange aspect of filmmaking. And as you said, it's like the most in-your-face thing when you watch a movie, and yet it's a very hard process to define. In a very, very broad sense, we will start a dialogue with the director or producers very, very early. We're often the first people hired, even years in advance. A director we work with a lot, let's say, will send us a script. Here, I'm making this in 5 years, 2 years, hopefully. What do you think? And then we start batting around ideas. In some cases, not to get too in the sausage making, but a film will come to us with actors already in it. Dallas Buyers Club, which you mentioned, Matthew McConaughey was already there, and then we cast around him. In an ideal world, no one's cast, as with Winter's Bone, which you mentioned, and we audition everybody or have the director meet with people, and we cast it from scratch, which is what we did with that and Pitch Perfect film, the first one. So it depends on the project, really. And generally speaking, a casting director that you'll see listed in casting by, usually at the front of the film, is responsible for finding the actor for every speaking part. Mm-hmm. Extras casting is a different animal, different job. So in a very, very short version, that's what we do.
I think what's amazing as a consumer of films is that it just seems as though there's a platonic essence to, like, Jared Leto in that part in Dallas Buyers Club. I mean, the process of the actor is to inhabit it so totally.
Right.
You can't imagine them not being the person. Nonetheless, is the process of winnowing painful in the sense that there are options and choices? I mean, you're making them all the way to,
yes.
Does it come down to two, or is there a gestalt where you're like, oh, platonic essence, Jared Leto or Jennifer Lawrence for Winter's Bone, and then it's like,
yeah,
the process is actually quite easy.
It can be a mix. And for example, with Dallas Buyers Club, again, since Matthew McConaughey was already there, he was anchoring the cast in a way that everyone around him had to make sense in whatever sort of vague way you want to interpret that. Ditto Winter's Bone. We did audition a lot of women for Jennifer's role. And there was something, it's sort of like the Godfather Thunderbolt. You know, she came in, she read, and it was sort of like, holy shit, that's... And so I showed it to Deborah Granick the next day, and let's take a look at her, and then she flew to New York, and so on and so forth. So, yeah, it's weird, because also, you know, you're talking about, if you want to draw the analogy between what we do and what a set designer does, putting those puzzle pieces together to the gestalt, as you put it, it's weird because we're talking about human people who walk and talk and say the lines as opposed to, you know, a painted backdrop or a sofa or whatever. So you very rarely, I think, hear somebody, a regular moviegoer, see a movie and say, oh, that couch looked way out of place. But you constantly hear, and I've seen it in reviews, so-and-so was miscast, this person wasn't right for the role, whatever. And you can kind of only go by the director's instincts, your own instincts, the audition, if you're lucky, and sometimes what we call chemistry reads, where we'll get different actors together if there's an ensemble, and cross your fingers and hope that you're right. You know, it's a high wire act for sure.
And then hopefully the rest of your life you get a Christmas card from Jennifer Lawrence.
Hopefully. Right? I don't, but yes, that'd be nice. My mother is still angry that she doesn't thank me at every opportunity that she's on television.
One of the contrasts in what you were just describing is, you know, the star versus the unknown, right? Which I assume each is a different kind of get, right? It's a great get that you get somebody who's a huge name and it's going to attract a lot of financing and other stars to the film. But it's also great when you dig up a gem like Jennifer Lawrence, right? Who I assume, had she done theater before that? Had she done TV?
She had done a television show. She was already with a big agency, CAA. She was
right.
Completely out of nowhere.
Right.
But, you know.
But she definitely qualifies
speaking.
As, yeah, like
I think so, yeah.
A discovered treasure. Yeah. And so I'm wondering, I guess when you're casting a movie, obviously it depends if it's an indie, what the budget is, et cetera. But to what degree is it valued to dig up that gem? And is that something that's disappearing as, you know, financing for movies gets harder to secure?
To the last question, yes, I think it is, probably to your last question. It's so hard to make a film. It takes so long. It's so expensive. And people who invest in films want to minimize their risk. And one of the only ways to do that, I think, is with cast. You know, and again, not to get too in the weeds, but if you have X actor, and there's a list of them, I'm sure, that sales agents have somewhere, you can pre-sell your movie in Germany, the UK, whatever it is, based on that star's track record, which is why you saw, not to name names because I don't know them personally, but Bruce Willis or Nicolas Cage and all these huge action movies, say, in the late 90s, early 2000s, that would pre-sell in China or wherever. And it was almost irrespective of whether or not they were right for the part in a weird way. So there's that calculation that is always going to be there and I think is getting worse in the sense that it's more important. So I don't know that Winter's Bone setup would happen today. I mean, you have to have somebody investing who says, here's your $2 million in the case of Winter's Bone, go make the movie.
Do you also have a similar issue on who wants to be an actor today? I mean, it's just interesting and striking, I think, to chat with young people who want to be influencers, you know? Is it sort of like being a baseball scout as football was rising or something where the talent, have you seen that start to affect the talent pool or are you looking at TikTok performers or people who are doing a different kind of performance?
Yes, rightly or wrongly, we are. And it's really another sort of farm team, I suppose, that's added to your baseball metaphor, you know, to another avenue. It used to be prior to YouTube, really. I'd go to college and graduate school showcases. During COVID, most of them went online, which was great because then, you know, Ball State University Musical Theater Department didn't have to come to New York. So I go to a lot of student shows. I've directed some student shows at NYU. And those showcases that they're called that each school has at the end of the year to sort of present their class to agents and casting directors is a great resource. Seeing theater in general is a great resource, particularly here in New York. And then, yeah, the influencer TikTok, you know, their whole departments at the talent agencies now who just watch Instagram all day and try to sign people. So for better or worse, that is, I mean, to your original question about a young person, you know, I don't know. Is it rampant that young kids or young people are saying, I'll just be an influencer and I'll get signed by a big agency that way and I can bypass, you know, getting a BFA? Maybe it is. And on the more business side, now we are getting, when I make a cast list for, you know, a studio or a TV network, very grudgingly adding in their followers because the marketing departments of those entities want to know, are there already the eyeballs on this person? Whether they can act or not is often, of course, a separate question. And we try as best we can to audition them. And, you know, everyone is way more camera ready, I think, than they were 10 or 15 years ago.
And Paul, when disagreements come along in the casting process, how does that work? I mean, there must be times when a director really wants somebody, but you think that person is wrong, or vice versa, or both of you want somebody, but the producers think that they're not a big enough star. You know, what are the disputes that have to be worked out before you get the name signed?
I mean, exactly those. And sometimes we try to solve them with further auditions, maybe getting into a room with another actor who's already in the cast, seeing how that works. You know, it's weird because a lot of times I will have, you know, 3-4 days of auditions, whatever, everything goes online, and I send the link to the director and we make some sort of final choices and then send however many the director would like, 8 people, 2 choices, maybe only one. And then the powers that be, I wish I knew what happens at ABC or Disney or, you know, when those links go to these executives and we then get an email or call, this person's approved, this person's not, we want you to keep looking. And I honestly, you'd have to ask an executive.
Because they don't give notes?
They will give very vague notes, sometimes having to do with the marketability, sometimes having to do with performance, and both. I mean, sometimes we're told this person doesn't move the needle for us sales-wise. And usually I know that. You know, we all kind of, me and my peers sort of know that ahead of time, but we're trying to, you know, take a chance on someone. I wish I knew, honestly. Because it's very subjective, and yet the studios and networks, I think, are trying to take a quantitative set of criteria on a qualitative thing like acting or a human being. So I wish I knew what those calculations were. That's an educated guess anyway.
Paul, I mean, talking about a qualitative thing, obviously voting for an awards show and saying something is best couldn't be more qualitative. At the same time, it's totally definitive. So baking in that the whole exercise has a degree of absurdity in the first place, I'm curious to know, do you have a vote? Are you a voting academy?
Well, I am.
But obviously, we're not in a category for which you are actively nominated.
Casting directors have a branch, but no award until 2026. Yes. So what we vote on is really only Best Picture at the beginning.
I see.
And then we vote on everything because the whole membership votes on all the awards. Branches nominate the nominees.
I see.
So I think I know where you're going. My hope is that the casting community who are voting members, I think it's a couple hundred people, will have, just like costumes have insight to what their peers are doing, cinematographers, will look at a cast and say, okay, I can sort of guess that. I'm trying to think of an example. August Osage County, which we did. Meryl Streep and Julia Roberts came with the movie. They attracted a lot of great actors, of course, many of whom auditioned, many of whom did not. If there is room, I'm also a member of BAFTA. BAFTA has you prepare a statement. How did this work? That sort of thing.
Oh, interesting.
And I hope that my fellow casting branch members will, you know, it's not terribly difficult to sort of suss out how a process went, depending on who was in the film. As for the full vote, the full membership voting, you know, I can only hope that the 5 nominees of the casting director branch will choose are reflective of what is true casting as opposed to a marketing exercise, for lack of a better way to put it.
I have a follow-up question about that because I think with the technical Oscars, there is sometimes a dynamic where the nominations reflect the view of the branch experts, and then the winners sometimes reflect, like, which of the nominated movies did everybody see? Because they're also Best Picture nominees, or they were big, or, you know, the kind of literacy of the final voting group is maybe different than the literacy of the nomination group. And I wrote about this once with costume design, where the thing that costume designers are frustrated with is that period costumes and sci-fi costumes are always honored, whereas excellence in contemporary costume design is overlooked. So what's that going to be?
I mean, you guys, there's a casting Emmy. There are other casting awards. What's the thing that is the bright, shiny thing? Like, oh my God, they put so many ruffles on that bustle. I better give the award to them. Like, what's the version of that going to be for casting once the casting Oscar emerges?
I guess it will be, you know, the presumed or hoped for intuition of the other brand, of the other members as to, you know, it's been an education process in terms of casting being part of the Academy now for 10 or so years. And there are a lot of branches who didn't fully understand what we did, even though we all kind of, you know each other in some vague way. So I hope that's part of it. I think that the hope is that a film that you can reasonably infer was truly cast, if that makes sense, something like Winter's Bone, as opposed to, say, a film with lots of
The Towering Inferno.
The Towering Inferno, or, you know, something, exactly, where you get lots of famous people to show up. Who's going to say no to X director without naming names? I think the shiny thing will be how evident is it, either in reading press about it or hearing us. I assume that we will now be, God forbid, some part of the campaign season, which I'm dreading. But it will have a chance. You know, it's weird because I can't go on a stage at a Q&A and say, oh, well, you know, Steve Metcalf auditioned for this role, but, you know, he didn't get it. Because it's not the same as saying, well, the orange couch got replaced by a blue couch.
It's surprisingly close. You know?
So it's hard to sort of walk people through what we really did. All you can hope for is that they see on the screen how an ensemble was put together and cross your fingers, which I had a better answer.
Oh, yeah. You guys have to be discreet and polite. I hadn't even thought of that. You can't even explain, mm-hmm. like, can you believe they wanted us to cast so-and-so?
Exactly. I can tell, you know, off mic, I'm happy to share lots of stories. But, I mean, there's, you know, several people who came very close to Jennifer Lawrence's role, and I'm dying to tell them. Their lives would have been maybe possibly completely different, but I can't.
All right, I'm going to give you a chance before you go. Yes. This has been amazing, by the way, to name one name of your choice in a context that is innocent and enhancing to all parties, which is you were sitting watching a movie. You knew very little, if any, of the scuttlebutt around casting and the process. And there was, let's even say, a relatively small part, and we won't even know the name, but we will know the movie, ideally. And you were like, and it's an important linchpin moment in the movie or part in the movie, even though it doesn't have a ton of lines, and they nailed it. You know, one example in one of the pieces we read to prep was, this isn't a small part exactly, but The Boy in Anatomy of a Fall.
That's what I was thinking.
Oh, you were going to think, because it just spins, the whole movie spins 100%. On it.
Oh, talk about a hidden gem. That kid is unbelievable.
Okay, well.
Yes, and I that's the kind of linchpin cast where you just, I don't know what Anatomy of a Fall will be without that kid.
Yeah.
That he's so good.
Yeah.
And, you know, I read up on it. It was part of the BAFTA is also a juried award to decide on the nominations. Analogous to, I guess, just the casting director branch in the Academy voting on the nominations. So we have a 4 or so hour discussion for the long list and then decide on what the nominees are. And then we vote anonymously. And the kid's not really visually impaired and worked with a coach to, you know, I don't know if they put contacts, whatever they did, that's the one that really jumps out at me from recently.
That's a really good one. And if you get that wrong, it sinks the movie or potentially
sink
the movie. All right, Paul Schnee, it was amazing.
Oh, thank you so
amazing
much.
Amazing to come talk
Long-time
to you.
Long time listener.
And I hope we can find a really good excuse or a flimsy one even to
Happy.
Do it again.
I would love to.
Yeah, that'd be awesome.
Great.
Thanks for coming in.
All right, thanks a lot.
All right, now is the moment in our podcast when we endorse. Dana, what do you have?
You know, I actually changed endorsements midstream in the midst of our conversation about God Save Texas, because when Julia was mentioning the interviews with some of the people who had worked in connection with death row, like the woman who was almost sort of a publicist for the Huntsville prison, and, you know, a guy who was on what was called in a ghoulish phrase, the tie down team, you know, who sort of brought people into the gurney and prepared them for execution. Those were some of the most chilling and impossible to forget parts of that documentary. And they made me think of the great Werner Herzog documentary, which I don't think we talked about on this show when it came out in 2011, Into the Abyss. Have either of you seen Into the Abyss? So it's a Werner Herzog doc about Texas, about death row in Texas.
No. Okay.
And it specifically follows one case, a case of a triple homicide and someone who's on death row. But there's lots and lots of interviews with those kinds of people, with people who are in the prison industrial complex, some of whom, you know, like the tie down team guy, have become anti-capital punishment, just had a moment that they, you know, had a come to Jesus kind of moment, like, this is wrong. I'm now going to spend the rest of my life advocating against it. Others are, you know, more in a gray area. But it's a really, really profound, hard to watch, but really, really beautiful film about a very ugly thing. Into the Abyss, it's directed by Werner Herzog, and it's streaming in various places, I'm sure. I know you can watch it on Amazon Prime.
Julia, what do you have?
Well, I'm going to recommend a classic here. It's maybe not quite the same as the time I recommended Chinatown. We'll see what you guys think. But as our regular listeners know, my family and I are partisans of Cartoon Club at the New Beverly, which is a really wonderful revival movie theater here in Los Angeles, with a robust schedule. And every Saturday morning, once a month, they'll play kind of kid-featured animated stuff. Sometimes it's a series of shorts. But a couple weeks ago, they screened Lady and the Tramp, which I haven't seen since I saw it like on a VHS in the 80s. And we brought my daughter, who's nearly three, to her first cinematic movie experience, right? The little booster seats for the kids. My older boys were there, too. And that movie is great. It's bizarre. Mm-hmm. It's mostly bizarre because they make the dogs hot. Like, the dogs are hot. And I don't know, like, what... about the way in which they, like, what animators were doing, smoking, thinking in Hollywood whenever these movies were made, to be like, how can I make this dog's fluffy, glossy ears look like a seductive mane of hair and yet not have it be utterly, untenably creepy and bizarre? Like, I don't know. And, you know, the whole narrative is kind of ridiculous with it's basically like propaganda for domesticity. I'm not sure I stand behind the politics of Lady and the Tramp, but as a viewing experience, it was amazing. And my daughter is a true woman of California, because when I took my boys to their first film, I think they were five, and we tried to get them to see Singing in the Rain, and I had forgotten that it's about a stunt. There's a lot of like stagey violence in the first 10 minutes, which overwhelmed them, and we had to leave, and we didn't take them back to the theater till they were like 10. So anyway, I've got a little screen buff now, and very excited to be raising a Californian Lady and the Tramp fan. Although I think she now wants all movies to include beautiful, beautiful dogs.
Well, 101 Dalmatians is clearly your next step, which is the other kind of hot dogs of the 50s Disney movie. But Julia, I just have to say, since you were calling out the maybe vague Orientalism in Dune,
oh, yes,
that there is a wildly racist,
yes,
song.
Sorry.
Very catchy, but extremely Orientalist in Lady and the Tramp, the cat number.
Yeah, that is excruciating, that number. It does not work at all. And that is definitely worth flagging. My kids coming out of it were like, what? I was like, correct. Yes, good. That's among the things you learn at Cartoon Club, is what Hollywood used to do, that it hopefully does less.
But two dogs kissing over spaghetti in an alleyway while the Italian waiter sings to them, you can't beat that moment.
I was also a partisan of the hot cat equivalent, the Aristocats, you know, which featured the Duchess, voiced by Ava Gabor.
I think that might have been one of the first movies I saw in a theater. Yeah. I have a very, very early memory of the Aristocats.
Yeah, I remember digging it a lot. Okay, I'm endorsing. Either one of you read Helen Garner yet? Australian writer who's having a little bit of a vogue now, still going, still relatively young. And oh no, she's not really, she's 82. She's incredible writer. I finally started one, House of Grief, her nonfiction account of a big and I guess somewhat semi-scandalous or whatever trial, well-publicized trial in Australia. And at first I thought, you know, vagaries of the Australian legal system, and, you know, if we know how to do one thing here in America, it's have meretricious, super public, over tabloid covered show trials, you know, or whatever, or highly symbolically loaded trials. You know, is this going to seem kind of, I don't know, just sort of like a pale afterthought or something. I didn't know. I just was like, am I really going to get into this? And then it simply, her ability to describe people self-presenting or not self-presenting, just being themselves unconsciously in a courtroom, is so precise, beautifully drawn. The economy of language, it's like that painter in their master phase where they take a brush and they do a little swirl and all of a sudden you see a collar on a man, or you see a piece of nature, and it just is, it's so alive. And yet the amount of gestural sweat it took to produce it is like relatively minimal. It's just, the descriptions are, you're so vivid, but they bring more to the surface than a picture, right? They bring moments just choked with regret, emotion, rage. I mean, the underlying story is horrifying. A man driving with his three sons in the car, drives into a body of water, and he himself escapes and the three boys drown. And so the question at the heart of the question of culpability hinges on whether he did it intentionally or, as he says, because he had a sudden coughing fit and went semi-conscious for a moment and woke up underwater. But it's the amount of humanity that the woman can impact into a single sentence. It's like every sentence is its own emotional iceberg, and you're sort of wading from emotional iceberg to emotional iceberg. But then the total effect is extraordinary because it's a portrait of, a family, like going through a catastrophe prior, obviously, as they would have been to the event, and certainly since. I mean, it's just an amazing piece of writing. I mean, it's up there with Janet Malcolm for its craft and powers of perception. Anyway, House of Grief by Helen Gardner. I loved it. Dana, thank you so much.
Thanks, Steve.
Julia, thank you.
Thank you.
You'll find links to some of the things we talked about today at our show page. That's slate.com/culturefest. And you can email us at culturefest@slate.com. Our introductory music is by the composer Nicholas Pertel. Our producer is Jared Downing. Our production assistant is Kat Hong. For Dana Stevens and Julia Turner, I'm Stephen Metcalf. Thank you so much for joining us. We will see you soon.
The new Starz series, Mary and George, starring Julianne Moore and Nicholas Galitzine, tells a story almost too outrageous to be true, but shockingly, it is. With next to nothing to her name and looking to elevate her social standing, Mary Villiers sets her handsome and charming son George on the path to seduce King James I and become his all-powerful lover. The show is full of wit, scandal, action. You won't be able to look away. Watch the season premiere of Mary and George now, only on Starz and the Starz app.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.